I know a lot of people have been working hard with the gardens, trying to, you know, get everything canned, frozen, or preserved, however their choice of doing that is. But, you know, it's a lot of work. But one thing that, you know, any time of the year, you need to make sure that your livestock and pets has fresh drinking water. But when it's hot as it is and humid, we really need to, you know, just go the extra step to ensure that the livestock has plenty of clean, fresh drinking water. Wouldn't you agree, Kim?
Oh, absolutely. It is so important any day of the year, but especially when we get into these just unbearable temperatures that we've experienced in the last couple of days. And like you said, hopefully today may be the last one of those, at least for a little while. I imagine we'll see some more 90s before summer is gone, but hopefully we'll get a few days break after today. But yeah, water consumption is important. I feel like we talk about this all the time. And last time I think I was on the radio, we were starting to get into summer and some warmer temperatures, so we mentioned it. But now we're in the thick of the hot temperatures. So keeping water in front of all the livestock is especially important. I think everybody knows we have cattle here on the farm, so I tend to talk about cows more than anything else. But it's important for all those species, dogs and cats as well, for people that are pet owners. So, you know, and a lot of times we think, oh, there's water in the bowl, they'll be fine. But it really needs to be, I wouldn't say it needs to be ice cold, but you need to get, like, fresh water for them, especially if you're going to be leaving for a little while, because it is a little bit cooler than water that's been sitting out in these 90-degree temperatures. So the cooler the water is in terms of, you know, getting, I wouldn't necessarily say add ice to it, but, you know, if you can have fresh water, I think when it comes out of the ground from wells or whatnot, it's like 52 degrees. So that will encourage them to drink a little bit, making sure that it's clean. So if you've got tubs that you just, you know, stick the water hose in or whatnot and fill it up, make sure you kind of scrub those out from time to time to make sure that you don't have a lot of algae. I know I cleaned out our horse water tub the other day. It just had a whole bunch of, you know, green gunk, for lack of a better word, stuck to the bottom and everything. So making sure it's clean so that will encourage them to drink as opposed to a dirty water. And, you know, again, a lot of our livestock species tend to drink out of creeks and ponds, and those certainly work. You know, I know sometimes it can be expensive to come up with other water sources for those animals. But again, you know, ponds, for not having a lot of rain, can become a little bit stale and stagnant, you know, if it's not a lot of water flowing through it. And that may limit their consumption a little bit just because it's not, you know, kind of fresh and clean and all that kind of stuff. And I know livestock are not humans, so I don't want to say think about whether or not you would drink out of the pond or the creek, because I don't think we need to go to that extreme. But still, you do need to think about it along those lines a little bit. You know, do you really, you know, just take 5 minutes, clean out that tub. If it's got a whole bunch of, you know, leaves in it or like I said, green gunk in it, just do those things that won't take very long, but it could encourage your animals to drink enough water so that they don't run into any sort of dehydration problem. So we really can't stress it enough with the temperatures and the humidity that we've been seeing. Water is extremely important to make sure these animals don't get into any kind of heat stress issues and everything. So just take a few extra minutes and think about that.
Well, I think that's some good advice. Kim, here it is. We've had some decent rain from time to time, and a lot of the corn that's planted looks good, soybeans and some good-looking tobacco. You know, the pastures and hay fields, you know, probably could stand more water that they have been receiving. But as far as maybe if the pastures are not growing, you know, as much grass as you would like to have for your cattle, this time of the year, forage management is extremely important, correct?
It really is. I know it's hard to think about stuff like that, but the more we can manage our forages, the more forage we will have for our animals, and so potentially the less hay we may have to feed them. And so somebody said something about this about for acres of pasture, but, you know, an acre is 43,560 square feet of a solar collector, because every square foot of an acre, if you have it ready to accept and utilize any sunlight that hits it and also any rain that hits it, then you will be able to maximize the benefits of those two inputs, the sunshine and the rain. So if you've got grass in your pasture and you've got more grass than you've got bare ground, then that grass is going to collect that sunlight in its leaves and be able to grow more grass. If you've got grass or forages that you want as opposed to bare ground, then the same thing applies, but it also is going to allow that water that falls, the rain that falls, to be collected in the ground and absorbed in the ground and not just run off. So those grass plants, those forage plants, are really good collectors of both sunlight and rain. It also provides a shading and cooling, well, I don't say cooling, but maybe a non-heating effect to the soil. So if you've got bare ground, and I'm not going to remember the numbers and the amount that it changes, but if you've got bare ground out there and we have sunlight hitting it all the time, it's going to be a whole lot hotter. If you stick a thermometer down there, it's going to be a whole lot hotter than if you've got, you know, same soil types, same temperatures, but that ground has grass or forages on it, because those grass plants shade that soil and it doesn't heat up as much. So if it's not heating up as much, you're not having as much moisture from the soil evaporate. You're not drying that soil out as quickly. So having that grass, that forage cover out there in that pasture or hayfield or whatever, can help grow forages more, because you're collecting the sunlight, you're collecting the rainwater, and you're keeping the soil temperatures lower and a better range for those plants to do a good job of growing. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, it's easy to just, oh, yeah, the cows, the horses, the goats, whatever, they can graze this grass down a little bit more. But if you can leave that out there, then you'll actually see that you get more grass growth later down the road. Now, obviously, we've got to have rainfall, and that's something that we're not in control of. But, you know, all things being equal, if you can leave some grass out there and not let your animals graze it all the way down to the ground, then you will get quicker, better, faster regrowth of that grass if it's got, you know, kind of a base to work with. And when I say leave grass out there, if we're talking about fescue pastures, which is what most people around here have, don't let the animals graze it shorter than 4 inches. And I know some people out there are going, oh, my gosh, that's too much grass to leave out there. I can get a whole lot more grazing out of it. And, yeah, you probably could, but you're going to be potentially causing some harm to that grass stand that you have out there. Leave it. Move the animals on to another pasture if you can do that, and let that pasture rest and capture some sunlight, capture some rain if we get it, and it will regrow more quickly, and you'll have more grass down the road.
Well, you know, Kim, one thing, when you have horses, they are a lot harder on pasture. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. they have teeth top and bottom, and, mm-hmm. and they can, you know, pull grass up by the mm-hmm. roots. And
absolutely.
And you know, but one thing, if you do manage your pastures and try to keep your weeds under control, you know, that is the best way. And, you know, anytime you can have your animals grazing and you're not having to haul hay for them, they enjoy the grass better, and it's a lot less trouble when they're grazing than when you're having to, you know, feed them hay. But with all this being said, Is it any kind of fall grasses or anything that could be planted for maybe, say, fall, winter grazing or early spring?
Yeah, we're going from one extreme here to the other, aren't we, Rob? We're talking about 90 degree weather that we're having today in the next couple of, or the last couple of days, and now we're talking about grazing in the wintertime. But we have to think ahead a little bit. Stuff doesn't just, you know, snap your fingers and it happens. You have to do a little bit of planning. So, I mean, today I think is July 29th, so, I mean, August starts in a couple of days, so we are getting to the time that we need to start thinking about planting those seeds that we may need to plant in the fall. And so when we're talking about pastures and hay fields, no matter what the species of livestock, if we think about perennial grasses, grasses that will come back year after year after year and have multiple years of living, then we typically think about fescues and orchard grasses. There's a little bit of Bermuda around here, not a whole lot, and that's a kind of a different type of grass. But most people think about fescues and orchard grasses for perennial-type pastures and hayfields. And so we're a couple of months out from the time to start thinking about when to plant those kinds of things. And so go ahead and start thinking about where you want to plant that. Is that field ready to be planted? Do you need to do anything to get ready to plant the field? I'm not a huge fan of tilling things up if you've got a fairly decent stand of grass already out there and you're just trying to thicken it up with overseeding. But do you need to put any fertilizer out? Do you need to put any lime out? And, yeah, lime is going to take a little bit longer to actually take effect, but you will get those benefits from it if you can put some out. So do you need to do any of those things? Anything else that you might need to think about before you plant that seed, go ahead and be getting that stuff lined up. And go ahead and get your seed lined up. And we have a couple of folks in the area where you can buy that seed, but go ahead and put your name on, you know, how many pounds of that seed you think you're going to need, and go ahead and get that squared away so that when you get ready to plant whatever it is you're wanting to plant, it's there, and you're not rushing around trying to figure out what it is you want to plant. Where are you going to plant it at? Where are you going to get the seed from? How much seed do you need? Who has that much seed? Go ahead and be making those plans now so that you can, you know, be ready to go when the weather gets right and everything is, you know, in the best or in a good place for you to put that seed in the ground. So, again, fescues and orchard grasses are typically what we think about planting as perennial grasses in the fall. If you're going to drill those in, the recommended rate is somewhere around 15 to 20 pounds per acre. So that gives you an idea of how much seed you may need to be looking at if you're going to, you know, so you'll know how much you need to buy to plant whatever acreage you're trying to plant. If you're overseeding, you know, into a established stand of either one of those, you could probably drop that rate back by about 5 pounds or so. But those, you know, and again, if somebody wants to call me and talk specifically about whatever their situation is, I'd be happy to do that. But that's just kind of the general recommendation overall. Certainly some specific situations may change those recommendations. And we typically have a recommended seeding date from about the middle of September to about the middle of October. That's the recommended best time to plant like fescue and orchard grass. Now, having tried to do this a few times, and I'm sure there's folks out there that may agree with me, a lot of times those times of the year are not very moist. We don't have a lot of rainfall. We've not had a lot of rainfall. They're not calling for a lot of rain, you know, in the weeks ahead in the forecast. So moisture is critical. If we don't have a lot of moisture, that seed just can't really do a whole lot in the ground. So I would say that's kind of a starting place to think about for planting those things. But you can go a little bit later if we don't have that moisture during the time and you're waiting for moisture to come in the form of rainfall. So those are a couple of options there. Now, when we start thinking about annual grasses, and those are grasses that just have one growing cycle, and for winter annuals, a lot of things that we think about are oats, wheat, rye, ryegrass. And they can be planted in single stands with just that one particular species that you want to plant. They can be mixed together so because they have can have different growing rates and maturing rates. A lot of people will overseed those into an established fescue pasture to kind of boost the grazing available to the animals over the winter time. So, and we're getting to those dates as well in terms of when it is time to plant those. And so it's basically the recommended time is about the same, the middle of September to the middle of October to get the best rate of growth out of there, because you're trying to get it up enough to deal with the winter that we have. But again, you've got to have moisture. So again, that would be the start date, but just know if we don't have the moisture out there, you can go a little bit farther into November waiting on moisture to arrive. And the seeding rates on those kinds of things are, it kind of depends on what you're trying to do. You know, if it's a single stand, you may want to plant, you know, like a bushel and a half per acre of those types of things. If you're mixing them, you know, then you want to reduce that rate of each one a little bit so that you don't have so many seeds out there and you end up with lodging. The plants kind of fall over once they get tall because they have the big heavy heads on them, and if windstorm comes through, they can kind of lodge, and then it's hard for the animals to graze it. And then if you're going to interseed or overseed any of these winter annual type grasses into a fescue, then you obviously don't want to plant that heavy of a rate. So again, somebody can call me with some specifics, specific questions that they may have for their particular operation. But, you know, think about that. Go out and look at your pastures. Do you think you're going to have enough grazing for the wintertime? Can you keep the animals off of a certain pasture and put one of these grasses out there so that you can boost your winter grazing? And if you see that that might be a possibility, go ahead and start calling around and get your seed lined up so that when it is time to plant, we do get that moisture in October or whatnot. You've got your seed, you're ready to go, you're not having to hunt it down and travel to who knows where to pick it up. So just go ahead and start thinking about some of those things that may can help you extend your winter grazing. And the Soil and Water Office in Person County does have a no-till drill that can be rented if you need to plant some of these things that we've talked about. I don't know off the top of my head that the tractor requirements for using that drill. I do know it needs hydraulics, so you do need to have a tractor that's got hydraulic hookups on it. And I'm going to say you probably need to be somewhere in the 50 to 60 horsepower range on the tractor. But, again, if you call the Soil and Water Office there in Person County, then they can tell you, you know, exactly what size tractor you need, all that kind of good stuff. And if you're interested in renting that, they can talk to you about rental rates and get you on the list of somebody that can rent it come fall. So that's another option. If you think you might want to do this but don't have the drill, know that there is one in the county that can be rented so that you can put that out there. And it's a good size. It's only, I think it only plants either 7 or 7.5 feet wide. So it's not so wide that it's real cumbersome to travel up and down roads as you're moving it from to and from your farm. And then also it's small enough that it will get in most gates. I mean, you know, there's certainly some smaller gates out there, but most people probably put up a 10-foot gate. So it should be able to fit through most of the gates going into pastures and whatnot. So that is an option. But go ahead and kind of get your ducks in a row, get everything lined up so that when the environmental conditions are right, you're ready to go with your drill and your seed.
Well, Kim, since we're kind of talking about that, and you mentioned fescue, I can never word this exactly the way that it should be worded, But if you are thinking about maybe planting some fescue for new pastures and things like this, endophyte, you want to get the, is it endophyte friendly?
Right. So, yeah, it's real confusing, and I catch myself from time to time saying the wrong wording or whatnot. So when we start talking about fescues, the what's been planted out there for years and years and years and eons is Kentucky 31. It has a endophyte, which basically just means in the cells, that makes the plant very hardy. So fescue can withstand our hot conditions. It can withstand our dry conditions. To a certain point, it can handle overgrazing and poor management. I'll just say it like that. That endophyte makes it tough. But with research and over the years, we have found out that that endophyte causes problems for animals. So in horses, if you've got mares, you've probably heard, don't feed fescue, don't feed fescue. Well, it's not necessarily the fescue, it's the endophyte in the fescue. And the endophyte is kind of technically a fungus. So, because it causes in mares prolonged gestation, lack of milk, or the placenta may be thickened. And in some other animals, we have found that weight gain is decreased. They may not gain as much weight when they're eating endophyte-infected fescue in the summertime. They may not breed back as well if we're breeding cows that time of year. So some of the symptoms in cattle and sheep and goats are not quite as, noticeable might be the right word. But, I mean, if you've got a mare and you know that she's supposed to foal on XY day, and then she's a month later, and then when she foals, she has no milk, that's pretty obvious symptoms. You know something is kind of wrong in that situation. But if you've got cattle and they're not gaining as well as you would like for them to gain, then you're just like, oh, well, you know, maybe my genetics not so great, my hay wasn't so great, my feed wasn't so great, or, you know, it was so wet this winter, or it was really hot and dry. You don't necessarily point it back to something specific because there's lots of other factors that can be going on. Anyhow, long story short, plant breeders did figure out what the problem was. They said, okay, we'll take the endophyte out of the plant. So they first came up with endophyte free, meaning no endophyte in the fescue. Everybody's like, okay, great, this is wonderful, problem solved, here we go. Well, the endophyte free fescue did not last more than 2 or 3 years because it did not have that endophyte in it to keep it hardy and strong and tough and keep on persevering. So then they went back to the drawing board, and I don't understand plant genetics enough to explain it. I have to simple things down so that I can understand it, Rob. They went back to the drawing board, and they put in endophytes into these plants that were good for the plant but were not harmful to the animals. And so hence they came up with what has been termed in the past endophyte friendly. I think people, and I know I have done it, would say endophyte free or friendly when they meant one or the other, because they start with the same two letters, FR. So now what the industry is kind of trying to get everybody used to saying is novel endophyte fescue.
And so these novel.
Novel endophyte. And there is a huge difference between Kentucky 31, endophyte-free, and novel endophyte fescue. They're all fescues, but they are very different in what they can do and not necessarily how you need to manage them. All there is a little bit of difference. But there is a big difference in those seed. So I would probably, in very limited situations, would I recommend anybody plant a endophyte free, because I think most of the time you're going to see that die out in about 3 or 4 years. I think novel endophyte fescue has its place. And so that is something to consider. I know some folks in the area are starting to plant novel endophyte fescue to be able to sell to the horse market, because then that is a novel endophyte fescue that is safe for mares that may be breeding mares. So that was a very long explanation, probably a lot more science than people wanted at 11 o'clock on a Friday morning.
Well,
but it is a very distinct difference, and I think people, and I've done it, people come in my office and other people in the industry, I don't think really realize that there is a true difference, and they are completely different. And so endophyte-free is not the same as novel endophyte. And neither one of those are the same as Kentucky 31 fescue. So there is a difference, and I think they all have their places. I'm not sure endophyte-free is really what I would recommend for too many people in our area. In cooler climates, I think it might do okay.
Well, I think you've done a good job explaining that.
We'll see how many phone calls I get.
I don't think you get any complaints, but novel endophyte. I'm going to try to remember that if I can. Well, Kim, now, just this question. You were saying that, you know, a lot of times the ideal seed planting time, we don't get a lot of moisture. And for cool season grasses, you know, fescue for people's lawns, the ideal time to, you know, overseed and reseed lawns is the middle of September, and it is a time of the year to put out fertilizer, you know, on your cool season grasses in the lawn.
That's right.
So what I'm leading up to is, here it is, almost August 1st. Go ahead and do your soil samples. And if you're thinking about doing a complete lawn renovation, after you do your soil samples, you need to go ahead and spray, you know, some type of grass and weed killer on your yard. And as it's dying, when you receive your, you know, soil recommendations for fertilizer and or lime, put it out, till it up, and then plant your new, you know, grass seeds and things like that. But what I'm leading up to, just for someone planting alone, not to throw off on Kentucky 31, but it is some other ideal grasses that would do good in lawns, and it depends on if your yard is full sun, you know, from sun up to sundown. If you have a lot of shade, it's a lot of different choices. So talk with some of the, you know, people at some of these seed stores and, you know, tell them what you've got, or contact, you know, maybe Johnny Coley, and he can give you some name brands of good, you know, grasses. And they also make a blend of seeds that are suggested for lawns. But what I'm really leading up to, now's the time to go ahead and get your soil sample done for your lawns. And you may have some farm fields out there. You may have some pastures where you put out fertilizer on, you know, say back maybe February, March, April, even early May. We put fertilizer on later this year than we ever have. But the reason that we did that, because of the weather and things. But anyway, go ahead and get your soil samples, turn them in, and that way you know what you're looking at. And as Kim said, lime can be put on any time of the year, but it takes a while for lime to get in the soil system. Correct, Kim?
It does, yeah. And it does. It will start doing its job and be a little bit more effective more quickly if you can incorporate the lime into your soil, you know, some sort of tillage or whatnot. And certainly if you're redoing a whole pasture or you're redoing your whole lawn, you may very well need to till it up. Maybe you need to smooth it out a little bit or whatnot, want to get some of those humps and bumps out of there. So it will start working a little bit quicker in that situation. But even if you don't till up the area at all and you just spread the lime out over your grass stand, it will still work. It's just going to take a little bit longer. And the time frame is like 4 to 6 months before it really kind of gets in there and starts doing its job really well. So, but it stays there. It's not very mobile. So it's going to be there for a while to do its job. Our soils around here tend to be on the acidic side, so that's why we have to put lime out there, and that's why we have to put lime out most of the time every, you know, few years, because our soils tend to be acidic, so that lime effect eventually wears off, and we have to put more lime out there.
We need to get a word on for our sponsors, T.G. Brooks Company, and also Owl Pride Foods. After the break, maybe we can talk a little bit about making sure that you read labels and understand the labeling on herbicides. And also, we'll talk about the popcorn field plot tour that's going to be coming up in August. We'll be back with more Gardener's Corner with Miss Kim Woods after these messages.
July, and before you know it, August will roll around and we'll be start heading toward the fall season. We can already be thinking about cooler days of fall, and it'll be here before you know it when we really enjoy getting outdoors again and doing our fall lawn work in our fall flower gardens. It's also time to kill those weeds in the lawn to be ready for fall seeding. T.G. Brooks Company has the chemicals to do it, like Fertilome and high-yield lawn and garden products, brands that you can trust. T.G. Brooks Company is fully stocked for fall, and meanwhile, if you still need irrigation, they have plenty of irrigation needs, such as hose and sprinklers and piping. For your work in the yard, they have yard tools like rakes, hoes, diggers, choppers, pitchforks, pruning saws, loppers, wheelbarrows, and lawn carts, and lawn sweepers. And for your flower bed, they have your hardwood mulches and dyed mulches and that really good triple ground mulch and Daddy Pete's manure and soil by the bags. They have mulch in bags or by the trailer or pickup load, and they can arrange delivery if you need it. So this year, beautify with fresh pine needles, and for planting, get you some topsoil, planting soil, and they have cow manure. They also have the Pride dog food, including the Pride Pro Series, and yes, they still have dog kennels, too. No matter if you are a homeowner or business owner, they can fill your needs. If you are the professional landscaper, they can handle commercial accounts. It's no wonder people from every corner of Person County travel to T.G. Brooks Company. They love the friendly family business where every customer is important no matter how large or small, and they're treated with courtesy. They serve homeowners, farmers, and those in construction. They have since 1936. We're also thankful, and definitely it all comes together when you pay a visit to T.G. Brooks Company in Timberlake.
Owl Pride Foods, makers of Owl Pride Premium Pimento Cheese Spread and Dip, is made in Roxboro. Pick up some the next time you're shopping at Hurdle Mills Market and Butcher Shop, North Main IGA, Supply Line Discounts in South Boston, Virginia, Food Lion, or Kenyon's Meat Market in Mebane. You can enjoy Owl Pride Premium Pimento Cheese Spread and Dip at Rock City Grill, Cole's Pharmacy, Triss's Espresso, and Clarksville Station. Owl Pride Foods, makers of Owl Pride Premium Pimento Cheese Spread and Dip, remind you that goodness grows in North Carolina. Try the jalapeno added for extra flavor. That's Owl Pride Premium Pimento Cheese Spread and Dip. We do appreciate the support of Owl Pride Foods and T.G. Brooks Company here on the Gardener's Corner program. Our guest today is Miss Kim Woods of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service, where she is the livestock agent for Person and Granville Counties. Kim, coming up on Tuesday, August 24th, it's going to be the Popcorn Field Plot Tour, and it's going to start at 9:30 and go until 11:30. And I understand it's over 140 varieties of popcorn. I never knew until Gary Cross started talking about it, all the different varieties of popcorn. So anyway, tell us a little bit more about this event.
Well, I don't know that I know a whole lot more than what you just said, Rob, but yeah, Gary's kind of a popcorn guru. He really enjoys messing with it, and yeah, he's got lots of different varieties planted out there in his plot, so you can see all the different types of popcorn that are out there. Some of them are from all over the world, so he's got different countries represented, different types of popcorn planted, so that we can see the differences. And he's going to talk about the history of popcorn a little bit, and then also kind of maybe look at what it takes to grow popcorn and if there are any markets for popcorn in this area. So, you know, it should be a good tour. It is going to be at the Oxford Research Station, which is basically right there at our office in the Extension office in Granville County. The flyer does say 9:30, but I think he's trying to plan on starting around 9 o'clock. So just kind of keep that in mind, then it will start around 9 o'clock, and then hopefully we'll be done before it gets too terribly hot that day. But it's open to, you know, people that may be thinking about growing farm popcorn, people that may just want to plant some popcorn in their backyard garden. If you're interested in selling it or marketing popcorn, anybody's welcome. So so it should be a good day. And like I said, he's kind of our popcorn guru, and I'm not sure there's a whole lot of other folks doing a lot of plot work with popcorn. So, you know, not going to say one of a kind, but very, very limited opportunities to see this anywhere else. So, and it's basically right in our backyard. So, again, that's Tuesday, August 24th. And, like, I think he's going to try and start right around 9 o'clock. So if you're interested in coming, call the Extension office at 336-599-1195. We're just trying to get, you know, somebody that wants to come, their name and a phone number, maybe an email, just so that if something crazy happens and we have to cancel it for some reason, you know, hurricane's coming, or God forbid we get, you know, locked back down from COVID, then we can let everybody know that's planning on coming that there's been a change of plans. So just call and reserve your spot. There's no cost, so it's not going to cost you anything to come see these popcorn varieties. We just want to, you know, try and have a way to get up with you should we need to do something like that prior to the event. But again, August 24th, about 9 o'clock in the morning is where we're going to start. It's over at the Oxford Research Station. We'll take you about 30 to 35 minutes probably to get there from, like, our office in Roxborough. So just to give you an idea of how long it might take you to get there. It's real easy to find. But come on out. It should be a good day, August 24th.
And again, 336-599-1195 to reserve your spot. Kim, I think sometimes a lot of people, including myself, sometimes get in a hurry and doesn't necessarily read the instructions or the directions. But this is something that is extremely important whenever you're dealing with herbicides, pesticides, any kind of chemicals. Take time, read the label at least one time, and it never hurts to go back and read it again just to refresh. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I know those labels are not easy reading. You can certainly tell that, well, I can't say that I know this for sure, but I believe that there's some lawyers involved in writing some of these labels with the way that they are worded. No offense to any lawyers out there. But it is extremely important to make sure that you read that label, understand where, when, how much, how often, all sorts of details on that label are very, very important. And I know I'm not a big computer person. I'd rather look at something on a piece of paper than a computer screen. So I printed out the labels for a lot of the herbicides that might be used in pastures and hay fields so that I could find them easily when I needed to find them and refer to them when I needed, you know, somebody had a question or I needed to look something up. And then I even went back through and highlighted the important parts of those labels. So how long you had to wait before letting animals graze it, or how long you needed to wait before you could hay that field, what the rate was for, you know, certain weeds, and other things that, you know, might be necessary, any other restrictions that might be out there. There are some products that you can use it in a pasture or hay field, but you cannot sell or remove that hay from your farm because there is a residual that lasts in that hay crop even for several months after it's been harvested and taken to other places. That's a whole other story. But the thing is to read the label, understand what it's telling you. You know, some of these labels, it has different time frames of when animals can go back and graze that pasture based on the type of animal it is. Most of the time it has to do with lactating dairy animals, and that could be dairy cows, dairy goats, dairy sheep, because, you know, that milk is most likely going to be used for human consumption if they're dairy animals. So there's a longer, for many of them, there's a longer grazing restriction time for those lactating dairy animals to make sure there's not any sort of issue going through the system of the animal and then through the milk. Some of them, there's not a difference, but just the important thing is to read the label. Make sure you understand what that label says. And a lot of these herbicides are targeted at broadleaf weeds. So broadleaf weeds being something that doesn't really look like a grass. So clover would be considered a broadleaf weed. We have a lot of horse nettle here on our place, so horse nettle is a broadleaf weed. Pigweed, plantain, dock, those are all broadleaf weeds as opposed to grass-type weeds, which might be Johnson grass or crabgrass or Dallas grass or those kind of things. So most of the herbicides that we use around here are broadleaf weed herbicides because we don't have a lot of options in fescue in the pasture and hayfield world to kill out grass species that we don't want. Now you start talking about yards and golf courses, they have a lot of herbicides that they can use to get rid of, say, crabgrass in a fescue yard, but we don't. So most of the herbicides that we talk about are targeted to kill broadleaf weeds. Well, there's a lot of broadleaf crops that are grown around here, and probably the biggest one in terms of probably acreage and dollar amount is tobacco. So be mindful of where you're spraying whatever it is that you're spraying and think about, is there any tobacco around? Are there any soybeans around? Are there any, you know, does my neighbor have a fantastic garden that, you know, I don't want any of my herbicide to actually accidentally drift over to my neighbor's garden and maybe, you know, damage their tomatoes. So just think about where you're spraying, what you're spraying, what are the environmental conditions. Don't spray when it's windy because the wind can make that herbicide drift over to another area. So just think about that. And case in point, you can do it to yourself. So we, here right beside our house, we have a pink dogwood tree. And I have a few little plants planted under the dogwood tree, so we had gotten out, I don't remember even what herbicide it was, to spray like around the flower bed border of the flower bed underneath the dogwood tree, just trying to kill some grass or, I don't know, some other broadleaf weed that was, I think it was a broadleaf weed killer, trying to kill some of that stuff that had come up around the edge of the flower bed border underneath my dogwood. Did not think anything about it. Sprayed whatever it was that we had. I can't remember what it was. And maybe a month later, we're like, golly, the leaves on this dogwood tree are just curling up. What in the world is going on? And we kept noticing that it got a little bit worse, And we're like, what is going on with this dogwood? Nothing else seemed to be affected. And finally, it dawned on us. We had sprayed those broadleaf weeds kind of underneath that dogwood tree, and the vapors had risen up enough and gotten on the leaves of the dogwood tree, and it was affecting the dogwood. Those leaves had curled up. It just looked really, really stressed, and we were afraid we were going to lose the tree. So I talked to Johnny about it, Johnny Coley, like, is there anything I can do? He was like, no, not really. There's nothing you can do to, you know, kind of get rid of that herbicide that's down there. But what we did was we watered the plant, watered the tree. Well, we don't normally water the tree, but we watered the tree a lot so that it was not additionally stressed from drought. So as far as I can tell, the tree is saved because it's still out there. But we did it to ourselves. I can't point the finger at anybody else.
So it doesn't take much.
Not take much. With some of these herbicides and some of the susceptible plants, like tomatoes and tobacco and soybeans in some cases, peppers, those are very susceptible plants to some of the broadleaf herbicides that we have available to us. And it can be like parts per billion can cause a problem. So just think about it, you know, and again, you can do it to yourself like we did here at home. Just think about what it is you're spraying, where are you spraying it, is anything, you know, where can this go if the wind is blowing, where can this go if we get a 3-inch rain later tonight, and just, you know, read the labels to make sure you understand, is this herbicide okay to use on whatever crop that you're wanting to use it on? Or is it okay to spray where there's horses or cattle? How long do I need to keep them off? All that stuff is very important. I know those labels get wordy. I know they get difficult to read, but all the information in there really is important. And if you have something that you use over and over again, keep a copy of the label and highlight that important stuff so you don't have to go back and hunt for it and go, I know it says in here somewhere how long I have to wait before I can cut hay. Where is that at? Highlight it, and then you can find it easily again the next
time.
Have
it as a quick reference. Good idea. Yep. Well, Kim, a lot of good information you've provided to our listeners, and I appreciate you doing just that.
Sure.
Special thanks to all of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension agents. They're there to help you out. They're a phone call away. They have a wealth of knowledge, and they have two universities to help back up the knowledge that they may need. Also, we appreciate T.G. Brooks Company and Our Pride Foods for their support here on the Gardener's Corner program. Stay cool. Have a good and safe weekend. And, Kim, again, thank you, and hope to talk with you soon.
Yep, sounds good. I hope everybody has a good weekend, and stay cool and stay hydrated.
96.7 WKRX.